Hadi bakalım.
The world is starting to question the sacred cultural pillars of the West, and the legacy opinion makers are not dealing with it well. We're going to be talking about Dave Smith versus Douglas Murray debates today, specifically the what it means and the fallout, because this might be a watershed moment on a longer term trend about the internet, honestly, about information and how people are consuming it. And there's so much to unpack here that go very deep into our cultural roots. So totally pumped to talk about it with you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Human Reaction. We are your weekly source for independent commentary. That means completely uncredentialed on cultural news and politics. I've got my friend David Rand here reporting in remotely once again from Helena, Montana, where he's doing the Lord's work on Capitol Hill here in the state of Montana. David, how's it going up there?
No, it's all right. Day 75. Today I had my son's school came to visit the Capitol, so I got to act as tour guide too, which was a lot of fun.
That's a blast. I love that. Take your son to work day.
Yeah, exactly. Something like that.
I love it. Before we get started, everybody, please do make sure to like and subscribe if you're on YouTube. We would love it if you would smash that like button. And if you're watching on Spotify or anywhere else, please do leave us a review. It helps us tremendously. All right, David, let's get into the show.
Yeah, so everyone's seen the Douglas Murray debate at this point. I mean, 2 days after a Joe Rogan experience, we're still, my X feed is just this. There's just commentary on it from both sides. And more interesting, like every time you're seeing someone engage, specifically from the Douglas Murray side, it is very interesting how it's all played out. I don't want to get into a big, like, here's what's on X type episode, but I feel like what's going on here is a very interesting cultural moment. So to kind of kick us off, you know, we got our you know, the one of the big things that came out of it was this idea of credentialism. And after the debate, now Dave's been on a bunch of programs, Murray's been on a bunch of programs. Douglas Murray was on Unheard with another Brit talking about this stuff. And we got this clip of him kind of talking about his critique on credentialism. And I think I'm packing it a little bit more, and I think in an important way.
I mean, Joe's a friend, and I was trying to be gentle with him about what I regard as being a dangerous tilt that he and some other podcasters are encouraging. What I really maybe should have said then, can now, is that everybody recognizes expertise in the areas they know about. And for instance, if you had gone on Joe Rogan and sought to spend 3 hours talking about MMA fighting,
wouldn't be very convincing.
That's my guess. I mean, it may surprise me, but I would think that quite early on, he would work out that you didn't really know what you're talking about. And if you said, hey, I never said I'm an MMA expert, I just want to keep talking about it, then at some point they would have to call bullshit on you and they'd get very annoyed. Well, okay, that's the same with lots of other things. I get very annoyed when I hear people who are in no way recognizably historians, in no way recognizably expert in the subjects they talk about, regurgitating false versions of history that I saw debunked already in my lifetime. I mean, there's an area of the American right.
Yeah, so I think, and at the end of the day, you have to be a little bit older and familiar with the conservative movement to really, I think, grasp what he's going at here. This is an old criticism that goes back to when The Daily Show was like the number one news source for millennials. And it was very frustrating to Conservative Inc. because they had their power base center, which was talk radio, and they didn't really have cable news. And then even worse than that, you had this, yeah, very clearly a mono narrative out of The Daily Show that was a comedy show, but it was also really formulating a lot of opinion amongst millennials at the turn of the early 2000s to mid 2000s. In that time frame, there was a clip, and I wanted to find it, but I wasn't able to get it together for this, of Jon Stewart basically being challenged by someone from the right, and him backing off and doing exactly what he's accusing Dave Smith of doing, which is, well, I'm just a comedian. This is actually up to you guys to understand. I'm just poking fun. I'm just critiquing it. You guys are the experts who are actually supposed to be running things. But the important thing to understand here is that Dave Smith doesn't do that. That no, you can't find examples of doing that. In fact, on his show, he mentioned he might have fallen to that one time way back in the day when he was very first getting started out, but he quickly realized what kind of error that is. And it's specifically an error because of the point of view. As a libertarian, you're in a position where you're saying, no, actually regular people can grapple and should be grappling with these points, because these are the things that they use our tax dollars to do. And if we don't, no one will. And so if it's just left up to the experts, then they're going to be ruled by experts. Now, John Stewart, he, of course, can have that point of view, and it's perfectly consistent because he thinks we should be ruled by experts. That's what progressivism is at its core, is the rule of experts and ruled by technocrats. So if it only experts can speak with authority on things, only experts can make arguments about public policy, well, that enforces and creates the very systems in which he opposes as a libertarian. So therefore, there's no point where you can point to it and say, this is what Dave Smith is actually doing, even as he's not claiming to be an expert. But neither is Douglas Murray. Douglas Murray is an expert on nothing other than neoconservatism, which he wrote a book about. You know, so yeah, you know, wait, what is he an expert in? He's a literary major from Oxford, right? So it's obviously a contradiction in itself.
He seems to be a bit of an expert in being pretentious. I will say that. Maybe that's just the British. I don't know.
Yeah, I can't tell if it's. I think people's ear hear different things when they hear British. Right. Like people hear suave and they hear intelligent. And if you're not of the type to be like, you know, taken in by that of the suave, intelligent type of impression, you likely hear pretentiousness. Right. And those are like the same side of the same coin, or two sides of the same coin.
Well, I think there's another piece of it where, you know, a Briton is telling Americans how to think about foreign policy that is directly impacting our bottom line as a country. It's one mm-hmm. thing for him to lecture, you know, his countrymen about that, but it's another thing to be talking to Americans, in my view. Do you feel that?
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, I like as open a process as possible to get feedback from British people about, you know, in international events. I think it's perfectly reasonable. In fact,
that's totally un-American, David.
It's kind of the thing about being a libertarian is I just don't care about the nations as much. You know, typically, like, does this person have something interesting to say or not? Are they engaging in good faith or not?
I completely agree.
You know, yes. And if that's the currency of the internet, that's what makes the internet so awesome, and it also makes it more of a libertarian like space, right? Where, you know, what really matters is what you contribute. Do you contribute something of value or not? And right. I think, you know, he's from the Legacy Press. He's a columnist. He's a book author. I mean, he's been on a lot of talk shows and he's done a lot of podcasting and stuff like that as a guest, but he's not a podcaster, right? He doesn't come from that natively. So I think that's part of the subtext too, that people are picking up on in the pretentiousness, is that this is an archetype, a condensing of the legacy media coming in and be like, well, you podcasters, you're not doing it right. Well, you should do it the way we do it. You should have to go to the country before you speak about it. You should have experts on and not just be able to talk to your buds about what you think.
Right. That's fair. And I think you brought up one really interesting point that caught me there, speaking about engaging in good faith. I think that's one thing that Dave Smith very obviously is doing on this issue. It's something he cares about tremendously. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something that he has done a lot of research on. He's not intentionally trying to misrepresent anything or, you know, cast it in a false light in any way. But I'm not sure that the same can be said for Douglas Murray, particularly in light of the debate that was had on Joe Rogan. He never engaged with the arguments. And that was part of the problem that I think a lot of libertarians saw with the whole debate, was that he was too busy running around in these little semantic loops, trying to just divert from the real topic of conversation.
That was one of the funniest parts to me. Like, people were like, I can't listen to it. I loved it. Like, the entire time I listened to it, I was like, I just love watching this guy not engage, because it's so obvious to me. And then additionally to that, when he actually makes the more libertarian point on the thing of like, well, it's not you going to war, it's your government going to war. It's like, that's actually a very libertarian point. I actually agree with that. But we use this as a shorthand, and anyone can get caught in using a shorthand, because that's what our culture does. Our culture identifies the government with the people and the people with the government in this really mixed up way, rather than as you would appropriately actually model it, which is the government is a leech that sucks the lifeblood out of peaceful, productive people so that they can go blow up people in other countries.
Right. Well, and if he was engaging with it on the philosophical grounds of that argument, it would be a different exactly. thing. But he was very yeah. clearly using it as a smokescreen to get out of actually answering the question.
Yeah, that's right. But let's steel man him real quick.
Sure.
When should you care about credentials? When should you care about expertise? And I think there is a legitimate place for that in your personal life. Right. And I can't take full credit for this thought, but I do think it's really important. And it's and a lot of Douglas Murray's actual ground that he think he covers with anyone who is kind of taking the side with this, I think in good faith, I think a lot of people are not doing that. But the people who are, and let's try to assume that for a minute, is well, it does matter if you have people who are educated in something you're not educated in and they're giving you advice about how to think about it. But, you know, you can have and listen to Norm Finkelstein talk about ad nauseum about all the details of the history of the Israel-Palestine conflict. And it's going to take 7 hours and it's worth your time. But and you could do that on the Israeli side. But we have these communicators who act as intermediaries in order to boil down and help people really grasp these ideas. You lose some resolution in that process, right? You lose resolution when you zoom out and you're like, okay, how do I really think 1967 till today? How do I understand the moral basis of how we wound up here? And we did like 3 episodes on Israel-Palestine right when it first happened last year to go check out for that. Where I think what I really tried to do was appropriately tell both sides of the story and really try to tease out the ways to think about it and how to approach it without being an expert, but rather just as someone who in good faith is just looking at everything I can and trying to generate opinion in real time for people so that, you know, we can encourage people to do that same thing. That step of courage of being like, hey, I can't know everything, but I got to know something here because these are my tax dollars at the end of the day.
Right.
And then secondly, like you need experts, of course, in your personal life. Right. And when you go to a doctor, like you're not, you want to have some degree of like, okay, this person knows more about medicine than I do, and I'm going to defer to them, but you also have a right to ask for a second opinion.
Right.
You know? And like that's where we're at as a culture, and we've made it so abundant to get access to people telling story, to people drawing out the narrative and trying to pull facts out and explain those facts for people so that they can contextualize them and incorporate them into their mental model of the world, that, you know, we've made it so it's easy to get a second opinion and a third opinion, a fourth opinion, and like all down the line.
I think
the legacy media can't keep up with that.
I completely agree. I think there's one other piece to the divide between the two of them in this whole conversation. And to me, it appears on a pride versus humility spectrum, where Douglas Murray feels very prideful about his expertise. That means a lot to him. And his ego is really wrapped up in being an expert on this topic or whatever topic he might be talking about. Whereas Dave Smith, to me, feels like much more on the, you know, the humble side of things, where it's like, hey, look, I'm just this guy, but I'm out here trying to figure it out. I'm out here trying to engage in the topic in good faith, trying to bring information to people, trying to speak up for a group of people, individuals that I feel are being completely wronged in this situation. And of course, I completely agree with you. On a public stage, there's no way in American society, hopefully more broadly, that should ever be thought of as inappropriate or censorable. And in the marketplace of ideas, if they're bad ideas, if Dave Smith has said things that are factually incorrect, we can hopefully find the truth and the data to show that. And I trust, and I've seen it before, and I have this expectation that if Dave Smith were ever proven wrong on something, he would completely fully own up to the fact that he was wrong about that thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't have that same faith for Douglas Murray personally.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it comes down to the fact that you have to trust people to be able to figure out the truth for themselves, to engage with ideas that might be wrong and not just like completely adopt them as gospel and run with them forever. Right.
Right. And what I see this is really the a watershed moment, as I mentioned up top, for a series of things that are kind of collapsing. Like visualize the cathedral in the Michael Malice kind of way. If you have these major pillars of our culture that are just crumbling on themselves. Right.
Yeah.
And what I remember is that moment on Tucker Carlson where he questioned the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, right? And while I've had my moral quandaries with that in the past, I never really looked at the, well, what was the reason? What were the arguments and who was on which side of that? So you go into that and you start contending with that. And all of a sudden it evokes out of you. It's like, well, wait, if you're reasoning from first principles and you're saying, well, should we bomb with this enormous, never before seen, you know, weapon that's never been used before in war that we don't really understand the collateral consequences of, you know, was that the right move? And from the Christian point of view, from Tucker Carlson's point of view, he's saying, of course not. It just can't be. There's no argument that justifies it. And that's a totally respectable position that when I saw the opposition start engaged with, they're like, well, of course you had to. After all, I learned in eighth grade that the only reason we ever did that was in order to prevent greater loss of life later. And that's not true, right? We don't know that, right? That was a justification. And we're contending with this relative propaganda of, well, the only reason we did it was because that was like, actually, there are a lot of other reasons. And if you look a little deeper, you're going to find those reasons. When you find those reasons, you're like, wait a minute, maybe it has something to do with the post-war peace and making an example out of Japan and killing a lot of civilians in order to scare the USSR. In order to use nuclear weapons so that we can control and dominate the world in the post-World War II consensus period. And it, once you're doing that, you're like, well, I don't know how to contend with this without now thinking of that, because you're the one, you brought it up. You said there's only one reason. Well, I just found a bunch of other ones, and now I don't trust you as much as I used to.
Yeah.
You know,
very true.
And that's like the application of things that, I mean, when Smith is talking about it, he's often going into like COVID and our distrust of experts from that. But I see this across all of our sociological and political connections in our culture. It's not just there. It's also in, Candace Owens brought to light for a lot of people, post-World War II atrocities committed by the Russians on the Germans. And, you know, we didn't cover it a lot. So just to go through that very quickly, and there's a great documentary in it. I'll post it in the link notes below for people to look at, done by the BBC about this. Because, once again, this is an area where I paid attention in high school history, but I missed this completely. After World War II and the occupied territories of where Russia controlled, there were 1.4 to 2 million rapes. In that process of controlling that area, the amount of revenge done on not that German soldiers, but on the German people, like regular Germans. And we don't see them. Like, they're just invisible in our historical, in our story about us and our story about the USSR.
Yeah, I can safely say I did not hear about that in my high school history class.
Yeah. 12 to 14 million people displaced.
Wow.
3 million POWs in that era with a 14 to 30% mortality rate. That means one third died. That's insane. A lot. And then we're sitting at looking at 1 to 2 million. We don't really know. Deaths, a lot of that from executions, starvation, and exposure.
Yeah.
So, like, if you're contending with that and you're like, you come across that information and that's new information to you about your own relationship to a very important question, which is, you know, we were allied with the USSR in this, and then we're seeing them do that, and how to contend with that. And you might bring in other arguments like, well, look, I mean, this is the terror of war and it's all these horrible things, but are you justifying, right? Are you, what are we doing here? Are we, but it's an important thing to know if you're really contending with, you know, what it means to go to war in our own history.
So there's a term that is thrown out around this topic. I mean, these topics right now, it's kind of being brought back to the forefront, but that is revisionist history. And I'm not entirely certain I know what that means. Is finding new facts about, like, say, the post-World War II period an example of revisionist history? How do you define that? How is it defined broadly?
Yeah. So revisionist history is kind of a slur in a sense, but it's also like a legitimate criticism of bad history. So, in the slur sense, it's you're telling a narrative that I don't like, right? Which we'll circle on that at the end of the episode. But in the legitimate criticism of it, think for a moment about People's History of the United States, written by Kami. I'm using this very shorthand and very crudely, to basically describe the history of the United States strictly in terms of social exploitation of the rich versus the poor. And this is reacted to by conservative historians to suggest that, well, that's that you're leaving out important things, important observations about it. And another way to think about like 1619 Project, the thesis of that being that America's real history doesn't start at 1776. It starts in 1619 when slaves are introduced to the Americas. And, you know, and these are contending with what is the lessons that we should run. These are normative values we're imposing on history, saying what is the important things to understand about our history, about our story of ourselves. In my opinion, is typically that these are weaponized terms that we use to dismiss history that's inconvenient to us. And I mean that even in the 1619 Project and their emphasis on slavery to the People's History of the United States, probably Howard Zinn and stuff like that, and that story too. But that doesn't mean there isn't important things to learn there, right? And like that, and the best way to engage with that is to engage with it from, well, but there are other things to consider, right? And that you can't tell any story that contains all the information. All stories boil out important degrees of resolution and angles that you can't otherwise cover because you just don't have infinite time. Right. So the question is what is useful to understand about our history and about our story? And what helps explain the world in a way that actually helps you navigate the world? That's what I mean by useful. Not just emotionally satisfying, but rather what gives you the kind of texture to the world that allows you to navigate it successfully. And then second is what's interesting, right? What evokes out of you interest. And so that you can be engaged seriously with, you know, facts that are true.
That makes sense. I think a lot of history, a lot of what is interesting to people is going to be narrative based. It's going to follow a thread. Like you say, you can't include everything. So how do you avoid that in the process of trying to find truth?
Right. So you can pick up Patriots History in the United States written by a conservative historian that's going to tell you a very different story about how great America was. And that mentions the downsides, but says, well, it was, we had slavery, but we also abolished slavery. Hey, we had social class exploitation, but we also, constrained that and learned how to, navigate that issue so that capitalists couldn't do crazy. And there's no doubt that, and like even from the libertarian point of view, there are plenty of people who owned the means of production who did terrible things to their employees and to the people around them. That doesn't justify just the fact that you support private property ownership doesn't mean you have to be on their side of the terrible things they did. Right. So, you hire Pinkertons to go beat up the guys who are protesting you because they don't like their working conditions and they want to see a change. That's wrong. So contend with it. And you say that's wrong. And and then the lessons you draw out of that. So another one. And I think this is the most recent one that has been the biggest sticking point. And this kind of touches on Kyle's theory from the last podcast about our relationship with Europe and our relationship with the British and how strange it is, how we treat them, how we think about them, how we kind of angle with them. Because, to the American ear, when you say Churchill, right? People, they don't have a religious emotion, right? They have good guy, Yeah. World War II. Got it. You maybe some facts like, oh, he was funny and he's a drunk and all these things. But there's not that reverence there. Yeah. But when you hear Pierce Morgan or Douglas Murray talk about it, it's like talking about Muhammad and you're Muslim, right? It's like talking about Jesus and you're Christian. It is up there. It's like, and this is a part of the thing that we're desensitized to if you kind of lean to the libertarian side of things. Talking about Lincoln in America. I'll never forget. I was in Washington D.C. working in on the Hill, and a gal that works the front desk. She had a Lincoln pencil sharpener, and she was telling me about how much she loved him. And it's interesting because in D.C. the iconography around Lincoln is quite religious, and George Washington. And I said, "Did you know he imprisoned his political opponents?" And she was like, you can't say that around here it's a tenet of a common story that's really important to people's sense of identity. And I do that because I'm a troll and I'm just poking.
Well, there's an important role for trolls to play in this. And I guess this leads me to an interesting, to a question that is circling for me around all this. Like, what are the the ramifications of these sacred cows, of these like cultural mythological pillars crumbling right now? What is going to be the fallout from all of this, do you think?
Yeah, I Hegel has this theory of the thesis and the antithesis. And it's this idea that you have a consensus around an issue, and think of it like a Taoist yin yang. You have a push that inevitably creates its opposite. And what I see is, as the World War II generation and the youngest of those are dying off, and the baby boomers are getting to retirement age, and you see a lot more Gen Xers in this field of leadership, of media personality, of these things. They don't hold them as sacredly because it's not as closely related to the mythos. Now, you still have people hanging on to that, like Douglas Murray and all these folks. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not really judging them for their, you know, initial commitments. But you see people, you know, not having them be the same place. And so it opens this space, this vacuum that then fills in with the antithesis that is, well, I don't see them that way. You know, Winston Churchill's kind of a weirdo, right, in a lot of ways. And there's a lot of weird stuff you can get into with him. And you can say, like, well, hey, you know, maybe he made some mistakes here that are important to our story about what we talk about World War II. Or Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I think more in the American context of, well, maybe that was a tremendous sin. And you can question that. And you can question that and say, well, I agree with Dwight D. Eisenhower. It was unnecessary and a terrible sin. That idea is going to have much more purchase now than it could 20 years ago, in part because the generations have changed. And the conservative impulse is going to be to try hang on to that, I think, naturally, because there's probably wisdom in those things. There's probably wisdom in, like, hey, you know, like, in our worst circumstances, we could do some terrible things. But if we never contend with them, if we push them down and never contend with it, we're, especially in a robust information environment, it's very difficult to. You know, like, take for a minute, like AI, have you seen these videos? It's AI replacing Hitler's speeches with like a very, like, the tone looks and sounds like a normal person talking, but in English.
I have seen a few of those. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So that would be impossible to do. Like, if the internet in 1990 had that, we would have shut it down. We would have been like, no, this experiment's over with. We're done with it. There's no way we could do this. Yeah. But when they happen now, people are like, whoa, he's saying something. He's not just talking in demon speak. He's talking in English to me. And it doesn't sound like a crazy person. He sounds like a politician. That doesn't mean you should take everything he says literally or to the fact or whatever, because he is a politician. So he's necessarily lying. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the appropriate takeaway, is that you should listen to those and be like, what is my government telling me? Because he's obviously lying about some stuff about his true motivations. And should I really take the government at its word? Because if he can be that convincing in German, a language I don't speak, and when it's translated to me in English, I can be like, wow. Then what is Gavin Newsom saying? What did Barack Obama do? Right? Like, what really went on in those 8 years? Mm-hmm. Was it really what it looked like? Or was it something else? And how much more insidious it is when it's in your own government speaking your language, and how easy it is for people to get taken in by it. You know?
Yeah.
So I think what we're going to face is this conflict of these thesis and antithesis of these cultural values. And we're going to have to create out of that a new thesis, a new something that binds us together, a new story to tell about ourselves. It can't just simply be this conflict forever. It has to work itself out. That's a blind corner. I don't know what it looks like or beyond that, but all I can say is I would suggest that it's going to be a tremendous conflict for some time in the culture. And if we deal with it by censorship, it's only going to make it worse. If we deal with it by having discussions about who you should platform, it's only going to be worse. It should really be, you know, engaged with, I think, in good faith, so that people can actually navigate, decide their values. And hopefully, and in the ideal world that I could see is say, well, I mean, war really is hell, actually.
Yeah.
It really is. And
how do you, how do you discern for yourself if you believe someone is engaging in good faith or not?
Mm. That's a good question. It's a vibe, I think, on some level. Is it a vibe? Is intuition? It a, Yeah, it's that. It's obviously that can be manipulated, right? That's a heuristic that can be very careful. Like the salesman himself is good at projecting confidence when there is none, or for, you know, lying to you with a straight face, you know, and you have to contend with that reality. And so much of this is made much harder by the fact that we don't really know a lot of things we should know, because the government has told us that we're not allowed to know because they've classified it. Mm. And how much of our foreign policy is actually determined by things that is never voted for, debated for by Congress. Mm-hmm. So when you're engaging in good faith, you have to take any grain of salt that says, well, this is the government approved narrative with an extra dose of something, right? That vibe check, like if you look at people who are actually on the other side of the issue from me on Israel, Palestine or Ukraine or whatever, I always try to find the guys who are actually not being lazy and stupid about it. Right? So you're just trying to find those folks so that you can find something to learn
from. So you have to know something about the subject yourself in order to kind of compare that, weigh it against what they're saying versus what you seem to know to be true, right?
I think so. And the drive by, I think the beyond the vibe check, it's track record. It's how do they deal with challenge? How do they deal with being wrong? Mm. You know, and I think if you look at Scott Horton contending with the opposition, you'll find a guy who's very persuasive, very, you know, assertive, but also willing to be like, hey, you know, at the back here, I said this thing and I was actually wrong about it. I mean, listen to him talk about the way he predicted and didn't quite get right the Ukrainian invasion, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You know, I mean, like that to me earns a tremendous amount of credit because you said, hey, I was wrong. I made a prediction. It was off. And I overweighed John Brennan, his wisdom and ability to articulate that to the Biden administration, because he's the guy who wrote the net means net memo. He should understand this. And that's an easy trap anyone can fall into. Right. So once you have that, you're like, okay, this is a guy who's dealing in good faith. Who's actually trying to navigate the world just like I am.
I think you illustrate that pride versus humility spectrum pretty clearly right there in that example. If you're willing to admit that you're wrong about something, I have more confidence knowing, okay, this guy is at least honest in this scenario in being able to admit that he didn't get it all right. And of course, as humans, I think we can relate to that on a very fundamental level because we fail all the time. So that feels somewhat endearing. Perhaps that could also be manipulated though too, right? You could you could be falsely humble. However, you know, on the other side of it, if you're so prideful as to never admit that you're wrong, then I immediately have skepticism about whatever it is that you're saying, because something has got to be amiss there.
Right. And at the end of the day, I think ultimately what's going on here is that there was when the legacy media had control, there was a false sense of the adults are really handling things, so I don't have to worry about it. And what we're experiencing is the abundance of information available to people is now allowing them to see other perspectives, and it's making them feel very uncomfortable because all of a sudden people are like, they're not following the rules anymore. They're not doing the thing we all said we were going to do. They're saying things that are crazy, and some of it is crazy. You know, and you're like, how do you contend with it? So like, it's requiring of us an adulthood to it. It's requiring of us to look for authenticity first. Of like, I'm just trying to understand the same way you guys are, and I'm pulling together the best I can with my limited time, resources, and energy to make it all happen. Mm-hmm. And that is the thing that makes podcasts work, right? Yeah. Is you know that Joe Rogan is just a dude just trying to do it like you are. Yep. And like the whole thing is flipped on your head when you say like, but your ratio has not been perfect. Your ratio of experts on either side. In fact, you brought out people who are not experts who are saying things that are untrue. So to give you a sense for this, Dave Smith was on Piers Morgan today, and he had a real expert. Let me get this guy's name right. His name is Professor John Spencer. He's the executive director of the Urban Warfare Institute. So he got on, and he was going to give the real take. He's like the bit that Murray didn't get to really kind of stick it to Dave and hit him with a knockout punch, really, after Murray softened him up. Let's see if he did.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think the overwhelm, which is what me and Dave were talking over X, is that Israel is intentionally killing civilians, especially children. That's not a factual statement at all, because it doesn't even include the base information. So it's almost like, you know, you just don't know the information you need to know to make that judgment. And, you know, let's forget comparing it to a domestic situation like Dave continues to do on Joe Rogan, Lex Fridman, others. Like, if somebody killed my kids and I know where he's at and I go to that apartment building, I kill everybody in it, that's murder. And that's what Israel is doing. And that's not true. Even you, Piers, have commented about Israel striking something and saying, look at the number of civilians. That's not acceptable. That's not how war works. It's not even how you would assess that situation, because it completely rules out what the law of war says about proportionality, about assessing what is the target, who is that individual, what's his value, concrete value. And then, which a lot of people leave out, is what precautions did Israel take, like we just saw recently, of calling everybody in the building and saying, look, the terrorist is using this building for a military purpose. You must leave. You must get out of this area, or all the other steps, these civilian harm mitigation measures. So that one's a really huge one, but there are other ones. Like when Dave said that there are more children to have died in this war than any modern war. That's just, of course, Douglas called that out. But there is a whole list of them, from the blockade, from the occupation, like all of these things were just counterfactual and not a logic that leads to a conclusion, but he's really convincing, and that's what I have a problem with.
Yeah, so I have and Dave answers that really well after that. And I want to note that, like, this sort of approach that he's taking, I think is really, it's interesting, because the way it zeroes in, and, well, you're not technically right on the definitions that we have pre-designed, like a bucket, and you're not filling our bucket, right? Like, you got this bucket of, we've already designed the right way to think about this. And unless you're dealing with it the way we're dealing with it, you're not doing it right. And it's a really great debate. You should definitely watch it. The things that I don't want to go through point by point and debunk it, but I want to note the way that they are contending with this is by saying, well, you're not actually doing the thing we're doing. We're trying to say, we're going to take as a given everything in the post World War II consensus. That is what is a given. We start there. And what they're missing is that Dave is a libertarian, right? And so the way he thinks about these things is not the same. He's coming from a very different tradition that starts with the non-aggression principle and then works its way to war. It doesn't start with, well, we have to go to war sometimes aggressively, and therefore we have to contend with, well, how do we judge the life of a human?
Right. It's more of an ends justify the means approach than Dave would ever take.
That's right. So we got the next bit here where it really gets into the just war theory bit, and we can kind of unpack it from there, I think, much more robustly. And I have a little bit on Dave's response.
But let's just say, okay, the exact same action happened domestically. If someone were to do that, you would call it intentional murder, right? How does the concept of intentionality change because a politician uttered the word war, they declared it, and it's taking place in a foreign country without appealing to authority or appealing to law or appealing to what war normally is? Can you as a human being explain to me how the concept of intentional changes magically because a politician uttered the phrase war?
Well, the thing about the politician, it's the framework. So yes, I can give you, and this is literally you're explaining in the question how you don't know how the framework of a war works.
And the, so teach the entire me. Stop telling me I don't know. Stop telling me I don't know and demonstrate it.
Question.
Teach me
I didn't
something.
Say you don't know. Your question, I'll teach you something. Your domestic law has a complete societal agreement on what those laws will be adjudicated and how they'll be determined.
No, it doesn't.
How a criminal deterrence, absolutely, American law.
Lots of people don't agree to the law.
If you kill somebody, then you'll be convicted of a crime based on a jury and a judge, all this. Then you want to apply that on war, but then disregard what the laws of war, the things that all nations have agreed to on, this is how we account for intentionality.
You can't do it without making an appeal to the law. You can't do it. You can't explain it to me logically.
The body of laws have accounted for how do you get over that intentionality thing. if you use the same thing, which is the when somebody says there's a war crime, or when you say Israel has intentionally targeted a civilian because, look, there's a one, if you have to go to the statistical thing, we have issues unless you're doing comparative analysis. But if there's one combatant and one civilian, you don't know that, okay, what is that combatant? Is he a commander? Is he the commander? Is he a regular soldier? That accounts for what is the excessive collateral damage, and that's where intentionality gets into it. But, oh, by the way, what have you done to prevent it? In the domestic situation, you'd send the police to go get that criminal and then try them. In war, if you're a member of the other military in which I'm at war against, I don't have to have an excuse. I can kill you on sight.
Yeah, so this is really great, right? Because this is the contending with starting on the basis of war sometimes necessary and then going there, right? As opposed to what is moral, just way to use violence? When can you do that? And then from there, unpacking to the point where you're saying, okay, now we're going to do it on scale. We're going to do it in the most dramatic way possible. When the state is at its biggest, when it's most dangerous, and how do we constrain it then? Does that make sense? And so you're at the very far end of the use of force and you say, now we're going to hold it back. And Dave's saying, of course, and the libertarian critique has been, and this has been best demonstrated by Murray Rothbard and his work, Anatomy of the State, as well as Ethics of Liberty, that there really is only one place where you can have a just war, and that is limited war that is defensive. Because if you unpack the moral theory of it, you're really sitting at a spot where you're saying, well, look, I mean, in every case, you know, war itself is when the state is the biggest, it's the most capable of doing the most harm to everybody, including its domestic populations, protecting, it's supposedly protecting. And you're in the situation where you're saying all these collateral consequences, all these things are just never worth it. And they've never had to contend with that before. They've never had someone with a platform like Dave Smith to contend with. So they don't know how, they don't even know what the arguments is on the other side, because they've had such a dominant place in trying to in the culture for so long.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So it's almost like, you know, the elder fish swimming along and two young fish come by and he's like, how's the water today, boys? And the two fish go, what's water? Like, don't even have a concept of what that is to boil that all the way back down to first principles of what, you know, what Dave Smith is talking about in this sense.
That's right. That's right. And it really gets down to, and I think that segment really teases apart an important component to where your moral theory comes from. Is it consequentialist? Right. And that's really what he means when he says, well, what is the target? Is the target just a regular soldier? Or is he the guy who's the bomb guy? Like the Houthis and dropped an entire apartment building on because one guy went to go visit his girlfriend. So they killed all these people and they said, huzzah, we got him. We got the bomb guy, right? Yeah. And that's because he was a high enough target that they can then create this calculus and say, we don't actually need to go just get that guy. It's perfectly, whatever. We never declared on war on Yemen, to be clear.
Or on Which the Houthis. Is the craziest, I mean, it's just the craziest thing for me to imagine that one person is worth so much more than dozens, if not hundreds of other people. Like, right. That's so antithetical to the way that we think in the West anymore. Like, since the days of you know, abolishing slavery, that has been like a no-go zone for good reason. Mm-hmm. And it's insane that they can justify it in this case.
The most beautiful traditions of the West are the ones that say that there's an inherent, beautiful dignity to the individual, that everyone's created in the image of God. Like, that idea is our nobility. It's our greatest virtue. Is the thing that made us have to contend with the evil of slavery and the suffragettes and all these other components to our social order to redeem them and say, no, you're just as valuable as everybody else.
Right.
Like, that itself is the most beautiful idea we have. And then just to take that and be like, then count, we decided the politician uttered the phrase war. We didn't debate it. We didn't declare it. We didn't do anything else other than just, well, European shipping lines are under threat. So therefore we could drop that building and kill all those innocent people.
It's amazing. It's amazing. Yeah. The way they can come to that conclusion personally.
Right. And to contrast that with what Dave Smith is doing, which is deontological moral theory, right? It says that the virtue of an action is not in its result. in its benefit to you, the virtue of the action, the ethics, the morality of the action is in the act. It's in the thing. Does it comply with the first principles, the law of nature, the laws of the universe, the laws of God, appeal to anything, but at least appeal to something. Don't just say the ends justify the means, because you know who else thought that? Osama bin Laden, Hitler, Mao, Stalin, all the worst people you can measure. They were all consequentialists because it was all worth it to get the new man, to get the new era where we're going to overthrow capitalism and live in perfect harmony with, you know, poetry or whatever it is. All that shit is all done on the basis of consequentialism. And that is the danger of it. That is the, and it's always the inevitable result. It's just, it's the longer you look at this stuff and the more you look at it, the more you're like, wow, it just never winds up good. Right. I mean, there are people I respect that are consequentialists, right? Thomas Sowell being one of them, right? He's like, look at the evidence. Does the evidence comply with the facts? It just so happens that socialism never works because it doesn't comply with the facts. I'm totally okay. David Friedman. There's many others that I really like because they're like scientific thinkers and that's how they're making their arguments. And I'm perfectly fine with that. But that's not the whole of human experience. The whole of human experience is mostly in the deontological space of, and that's a fancy word for the morals and the virtues and the act. In itself, reasoning from first principles is saying, well, even if I does accomplish my goal, have I changed myself in pursuing it? Am I a different person now? Because one is contending with the malleability of the individual and in your limitations as a finite creature in a complex and world in a life full of suffering and adversity and limitation. And if you don't contend with that, you're not contending with the lessons of our ancestors. You're not being a conservative. If you're not contending with that, you're not being a good libertarian. If you're not contending with that, you're not even being a good liberal because you're not even embracing the institutions of the dignity of individual, which is the anthology of the liberals. So I wish our larger culture could contend with that more directly, right? Because it's such an important lesson that is just, I think just goes missing. When you have these kind of calculuses of, well, was it worth it? You know, and then and to put it into the Israeli context, and I think this is important, is when you bring that up, and this is the debate I've seen in other places, right? Norm Finkelstein has made this argument and others. It's often kind of articulated, well, that would be very dangerous for our soldiers, right? We can't go to every building in Gaza because we'll be attacked. So we're just going to bomb them. And that's what preserves our lives and allows us to take the lives of terrorists. Which I understand. I wouldn't want to do that either. If it was my kid who was in the IDF, I wouldn't want that either. Yeah. On this side, what are you losing when you do that? Right? And they're losing something very important, which is their own reputation on the international stage, people's understanding of who they are as a state. And, you know, and I'm not saying I know what they should do. I'm just saying you got to deal with the facts that's what's happening.
Right.
And then lastly, like, I just don't see how you can drift through that fog of I know exactly that this is the right calculus because the terrorist math problem and the Robert Pape dying to win problem and all those problems that we've detailed so many times on this podcast, that does it actually even accomplish its consequence, right? It doesn't look like it is. We got Secretary Blinken before he left office saying, well, Hamas didn't get rid of them. They're just as powerful now as they were when we started, despite all this loss of life. And all this loss of reputation for Israel.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And loss of humanity as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can't imagine. And you read the Haaretz articles and the Jerusalem Post articles on this stuff about the IDF soldiers and what they've had to contend with. And you just weep for them. It's just horrible. It's horrible and terrible. And like the decisions they have to make and all these things. And the fact that, you know, if you do buy the Dave Smith argument that this is a thing of choice, that this is not a place that we had to wind up in. This isn't just on the Palestinians and Hamas and all that kind of stuff, that Israel is an actor with agency that could have made other choices in the intervening time. I don't know. It's hard to contend with. So on revisionism, we got one last part, and I really did this because this is really the creme de la creme of, I think, where the opposition is going now of revisionism. And as you pointed out up front, where a lot of this is going to be turning on in the near future.
Hang on, Doug. Dave's going to stay with me when Eric wants. hang on, guys. Hang on. John, are we going to let you go, John? Before we let you go, I want to ask you just one thing that also came out of the debate with Douglas and Dave, which was this issue of whether people who have what most people believe to be bad faith, deliberate conspiracy theory, nonsense views. For example, Daryl Cooper saying Churchill was the chief villain of the Second World War. Whether people like Daryl Cooper should be platformed on gigantic podcasts like Joe Rogan or not, particularly if they're not going to be really vigorously challenged on what is something that to me is such an obviously untrue and offensive premise. What's your quick view of that?
I think that we should not platform historical revisionists who go back in time and find a fact and then tell it in a certain way to spin the narrative of what we should know about events. If you want to look at Daryl Cooper, look at the list of deleted tweets from Daryl Cooper. I'm against intellectually, again, no expertise involved. Anybody can research whatever they want. If they come out with a new finding, that's great. Using evidence, using data, using a research methodology. But no, you don't get to be a historical revisionist like Dave.
So Dave didn't get to respond. So I want to respond for him because this is, I think, super important. So Murray Rothbard wrote in one of his articles on historical revisionism, and it's important to understand that he is a highly trained, I think Harvard, I want to say. I forget what college he graduated a PhD from. New York University? I can't remember. But he wrote this on revisionism. Revisionism is a historical discipline made necessary by the fact that all states are governed by a ruling class that is a minority of the population and which subsists as a parasitic and exploitative burden upon the rest of society. Since its rule is exploitative, its rule is exploitative and parasitic, the state must purchase its allegiance of a group of court intellectuals whose task is to bamboozle the public into accepting and celebrating the rule of its particular state. The court intellectuals have their work cut out for them. In exchange for their continuing work of apologetics and bamboozlement, the court intellectuals win their place as junior partners in the power, prestige, and loot extracted by the state apparatus from the deluded public.
What a great quote that is. Wow.
Man, that guy could freaking write, couldn't he? But it's true, right? And that's, I think when you're picking up on the pretentiousness, when you're picking up on the legacy media's relationship and trying to deal with the new media, that's what we're picking up on, right? When it says, when he says, you can't quote John Brennan because he's a CIA director in one breath and then saying, well, I'm going to quote what the IDF told me when I was visiting Israel in the next breath. What you're doing is you're doing that, right? You're doing apologetics for a particular worldview because it fits your books. When you complain about Dave Smith going on and being on Joe Rogan and Daryl Cooper and all these people, but not complain about Coleman Hughes and Gad Saad and the pro-Israel people.
Pro-Palestine people?
Pro-Israel people. That's what Coleman Hughes and Gad Saad were. And you're not mentioning them. You just gloss over them. You just say, well, you just had a bunch of people I don't like on. What you're doing is court apologetics. They're the court intellectuals. These are the people that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And this phenomena, you note it not as a religious dogma, but rather as a phenomena that is observable, that there is an incentive to carry water in certain circles that give you invitations to the right cocktail parties. This is the globalist phenomena that's become so popular and so popularized. But it's the state that's the core of that. It's the exploitative class that is the core of what makes that the thing that it is. And contending with that means recognizing that there is a perverse incentive for them to gloss over the facts they don't like, to say, well, we don't actually know all the facts that lead to that. And so you can't make any conclusions or have any dubious speculation or theory about things. In fact, it's irresponsible to, because the plebs can't handle it. That's why they have the opinion they do.
Totally. Totally true. Man. That's such a good quote. I'm stuck on that quote.
Court intellectuals. Okay. I'll post the full article. It's on Mises.org for people to check out. It is fantastic.
Do you think that there's a degree of panic going on in the court intellectual class, the parasitic class that you just, you know, read about in that quote right now, because of the availability of information, because the availability of, you know, this really graphic footage and photos that are coming out of these war zones, that people are, their minds are opening to the realities of some of these situations. It's no longer like the Vietnam War era where you click on the TV and you watch, you know, your Walter Cronkite or whoever tell you what happened, and you have your one narrative and they can spin it however they want. It's like total free for all out there as far as information goes. And they're trying to like play damage control right now.
Yeah. I mean, it's, if you step back and look at the whole historical story, right. The real information control era was World War II, right. Where we got to gloss over Dresden completely. Right. I mean, yeah. I never got to talk to my grandmother about it, right? Who was in the States at the time and as a young woman. And, you know, but I did get to talk to her about her impressions about history, right? And I loved that conversation. I actually got to live with her for a couple months and have these kind of conversations with her, and the way that the lessons that she brought out of that time period, right? And, you know, you can't, there was so much more then. And so actually what's interesting is in the Vietnam era, there was an abundance more information, right? So like, think about it. Like when we were doing the banana wars, zero information, right? I mean, the Spanish American war, almost no. World War II opens that up a bit. You can get a little bit of video. You can get a little bit of, you can get these government propaganda videos. We've all seen them, right? Of that's all black and white. And, you know, we're doing the Battle of the Bulge and this is what's happening. You got the, you know, illustrated graphic and all that kind of stuff. Like you can visualize that. You can see like, whoa, that's just like, that's the first time the American people even got to like really contend with it in months later. And it's a government propaganda. Right. And then you have a little bit more opening of that window, a little bit more of that, like a camera lens being opened up to the widest possible angle. It's just opening up. And you see in Vietnam that all of a sudden we have relatively quick reporting from war reporters that showed things that were very contentious. But because of the First Amendment, the government had a hard time stopping it. And I like you ever see that video of the young Vietnamese girl, no clothes on, crying, and there's like napalm in the background, right? And like content, like the American public had to contend with that, and it swayed the war in many ways against them. And then you couldn't actually control Walter Cronkite. It was, you know, he was maybe an asset, but maybe not. But he had very leftist sympathy, so that he let things out that was not approved by the censors. And then by the time we get to now and you get on X and you can find that the horrifying videos of little babies with their limbs blown off and young men and a father carrying his headless son. And you gotta contend with that. You just can't ignore it. You see it and you gotta react, right? It just evokes out of you that human motive to defend innocence and the dignity of the individual. And you got to do something. And all of a sudden when that like, oh, if you engage there, they're going to come after you. And you're like, I don't give a fuck. I don't care. I couldn't care less. I just watched that little kid lose his life.
Yeah. I think I grapple with this sometimes and maybe people watching and listening do as well, but you know, Douglas Murray called out Dave Smith for saying we are at war, right? But, and we're not. It's our government at war, or it's our government funding another government at war. It's always governments that are at war. But to some extent, we underwrite it because we fund it with our tax dollars, and we don't stop it by putting different leaders in office that are going to stand on principle, or we ignore it, or whatever. In some way, like, we're all a little bit complicit in what's going on. So like, to what degree do you feel like complicit? To what degree should we feel like we have, you know, responsibility, I guess, to some of this if we don't have agency over it directly?
Yeah. So I've always contended with this two different ways. In one sense, I have a big enough ego that I can't not talk about it. I got to do something. Because I do. I have an instinctual sense of responsibility for the terrible things my government does. On the other side of it, I don't visualize the government as it's just us all working together.
Right.
It's not Sanders thing, Obama thing. That's not my philosophy, right? The government is an exploitative class. It's there to take from the rest of us, and they're just the conquerors who never left. The noble vision of the American Republic is at least we should debate it. At least we should talk about it and follow the rules that we set for our own damn government to do these things. If we're going to do it, we should at least debate it. It shouldn't be Dave Smith and Murray Douglas debating it. It should be freaking Rand Paul and, you know, and Chuck Schumer debating it, if that's what they want to do. We should elect people who then go and actually pass a law to make that stuff happen. It should be hard to do. But we don't do that. We haven't done it forever. We haven't done it since World War II. Right? And you have all this terrible suffering done without any amount of just formalities, or at least like have the consent of the governed in some sense, in some consequence. You know, Jeanette Rankin was a representative of Montana, first Republican woman elected to Congress. Elected to Congress before we had women, the right to vote for women. And she voted against World War I. She was one of like 50 to do so and lost her job, got unelected afterwards. Right. It was unpopular. It was the right decision, but she took it on the chin like a chick like with some man. with some real courage. Yeah. And then she got back in, and guess what happened? World War II. And she voted against it again. She had to be escorted out of the Capitol with armed guards. She was the only ones to vote against it.
Why was she escorted out?
It was that unpopular. I mean, the moment, this is right after Pearl Harbor. And she said, no, won't do it. I won't bend for all of you people. You know, wow. I mean, was she right? She wrong? Doesn't matter. At least there was a goddamn debate. And then she resigned before she even could run for re-election because she knew where she was at. And like that is, at least we could do that then, even if, you know, no matter what you think about those conflicts. But we don't do that. So I simultaneously can't stop talking about it because I see the terrible injustice and I got to, even though this is not my area of specialty at all or expertise.
Wait, you mean you're uncredentialed?
I'm somewhat credentialed on state policy. I'm not credentialed on foreign policy. I know quite a bit about the federal domestic policy, but it's not my area. But we keep talking about it because it's the biggest thing happening. Tariffs are important, but goddamn, we got some real problems going on. And we got to contend with them. And we can't ignore them. And if I do it, then what kind of example am I setting for my children or for the people who watch this show or anything else? We have to. Because the goddamn government won't. Because they're not going to debate it. They'll just go to war. So if that's where we're at, how do you not take that amount of responsibility? And the last part of that. So we have this opening of the aperture to now we see this every day. And the everyday people are now seeing the things that soldiers have been telling us about forever. William Tecumseh Sherman said it's only those who have never fired a shot nor heard the shrieks and groans of the wounded who cry aloud for blood. More vengeance, more desolation. War is hell. He's a Civil War veteran. Smedley Butler, one of the most decorated Marines of all time, said war is a racket. It always has been. It is possibly the oldest, easily the most profitable, surely the most vicious. It is the only one international in scope. It is the only one in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives. They've been telling us this for generations, and it was always behind a screen, right? But now it's on your screen. It was behind a smoke screen. Now it's on your screen, right in front of you. And what the hell are you doing about it? And you know, Dave Smith has an enormous platform. And he's out there saying stuff with courage. Maybe he's right. Maybe he's wrong. But goddamn, at least he's contending with it. And you know, it's the same thing for us. You know, you got to.
Yeah,
because the human suffering is too great.
Yeah, exactly. If I'm not much else I could do other than vote, I guess. If you believe in that
and speak up, right. And actually, yeah. And actually say something, because that's the only tool we have.
Right.
Right. And you're in like, and you convince the next person to say, hey, look, I know you're pro Israel, but like, we can't be backing these guys to do just anything. Look at this, you know,
yeah.
I mean, having those kind of conversations, like those things are possible. I mean, in fact, we see that now. I mean, there's a new poll came out this week you know, 53% of Americans now have an unfavorable view of Israel. It's a real challenge to, you know, the information dominance that the pro-Israelist crowd has had for a long time. And if you go down, you look and you see the swings on some of these demographics, pretty much the only people who are remaining in that position. Keep going down. Let me get this wider here. So I can see you. Yeah, right there. The only demographic that's really, you know, not changing is the older Republicans. And that's probably because of information environment. And that really tells to me, you know, what's changing here and the real opportunity for peace, the real opportunity for reform in our in this lifetime, which, you know, for a long time predicted the internet's going to change everything, is the information abundance. And the tighter that is, the more controlled that is, of course, people are going to walk away with a very different set of impressions. But if you're exposed to the entire worldview, the entire range, if you expose directly to the human suffering involved, it's hard to walk away with that. Well, we have to do it because the terrorists are there type of mindset.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, David, thank you for this episode. Any final thoughts before we wrap up?
No, I appreciate you, Joe, like keeping me on track to too much. And hey, and everybody watching, I hope everybody will please go like this, share it, get the word out there because we need people engaged. And please join our Discord if you're on, especially if you're on Spotify. We don't catch you otherwise. You can't comment with the rest of everybody else watching us on YouTube. So we pull our whole community together on Discord. You'll find the link below and please get in and get engaged. Sometimes I miss stories too and people will post them in there and it's really helpful. Especially as an amateur podcast that's not paid to do this stuff. It's really helpful to have our viewers at our back, checking us, giving us feedback, and of course, giving us stories to cover.
Yeah, and crowdsourcing some research. We have an army of uncredentialed researchers in our Discord, and we'd love to count you as one of them. And if you are credentialed, feel free to come on in too. We'll take one or two of those also.
100%.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much for watching, you guys. For David Rand, I'm Joe Sheehan. This is Human Reaction. We'll see you in the next one.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com.